Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank.
If you were a Roman parent who wanted to terrify your children at night, there's a simple phrase that you would utter in Latin, Hannibal ad portas, which means Hannibal is at the gates. From the 3rd century BC up until the Western Roman Empire's collapse in the early 5th century AD, this simple phrase reminded Romans of the mortal threat that the Carthaginian general Hannibal Barca posed to the Roman Empire. He was Rome's greatest adversary and the eternal boogeyman of the empire, and among military historians, ranked the greatest general in history. In this episode, I'm going to be answering a question from listener Jennifer French Lee, who asks about Hannibal of Barca's tactics, battles, and anything else unique he did during the First Punic War. But I want to go way beyond battlefield tactics and look at who was Hannibal of Barca, who were the Carthaginians, what were the reasons for the Punic War, and why was there no other existential threat like this to the Roman Empire for centuries and centuries and centuries, and when we say that he's one of the greatest generals in history, what does this mean? How do we compare him to other generals, and did he have any qualities that made him fall short? Also, I want to look at probably his piece de resistance, the greatest military maneuver he did in his career, the double entrapment maneuver. I want to describe what it meant, why it was so difficult, and why people hail it as such an act of tactical and military brilliance. Well, let's start off with a snapshot of what his life was like growing up in Carthage, which was in northern Africa. Hannibal Barca's name means Baal is merciful to me. He was raised as a worshiper of an ancient Canaanite god that demanded child sacrifice in order to be appeased. When he was 7 years old, Hannibal stood at the edge of a sacrificial fire pit and saw his parents hand over his infant sibling to a priest. The robed figure held him before a bronze idol and raised arms. The priest slit the throat of the child, causing quick death, and placed the body on the outstretched hands of the statue. It remained there for a few moments before sliding into the fire. Hannibal's father, Hamilcar Barca, was a Carthaginian commander and leader in the Mercenary War and the Punic conquest of Iberia. Hamilcar raised his son in the customs of Carthaginian society, which was founded in 814 BC as a Phoenician trading colony. Baal worship was as brutal in North African society as it had been 1,000 years earlier, when, at least according to Old Testament accounts, Canaanites slaughtered children by the gross. The Canaanites and later the Phoenicians stood out in Bronze Age society, so much to the point that in the Old Testament account, Yahweh orders Israel to completely destroy the civilization of Baal because they're a stain on the earth. Textual scholars have argued about the historicity of this account, but it seems that whether it's the Israelites or whether it's the Romans, the Canaanites, Phoenicians, and Carthaginians all struck fear into the hearts of their enemies. The chronicler Clitarchus wrote in the 3rd century BC that Carthaginian families promised at least one of their children to their gods in order to obtain favor. Plutarch notes that childless couples would purchase children from destitute families as a substitution. Contemporary Romans and Greeks found the practice barbaric. They thought that this was proof that Carthaginians deserved to be conquered, subdued, and, if need be, destroyed. But destroying Carthage would be very difficult and, under Hannibal, almost impossible. He represented the greatest existential threat to the young Roman Republic. The Punic Wars were fundamentally a struggle between Rome and Carthage over who would control the Mediterranean world. Rome dominated on the land, and Carthage dominated at sea. The Punic Wars are the clash between Rome and Carthage that we know best, but they were centuries and centuries and centuries into the making. Theodore Dodge sketches out the rise of Carthage in his book, A History of the Art of War Among the Carthaginians and Romans Down to the Battle of Pydna. Carthage was founded by the Phoenicians in their early settlement of Tyre. The Carthaginians acquired control of all Phoenician colonies on the Mediterranean. Their government was controlled by a Senate, and some called them the London of Antiquity, with London being controlled by a parliament. And over time, Carthage extended conquest all around the Western Mediterranean world. Carthage was protected by strong walls and had a vast commercial network. They had harbors and arsenals in order to project naval power. With Carthage at its center, the Carthaginians controlled North Africa in the way that the Romans controlled the Italian peninsula. The Phoenicians had originally been nomads inhabiting the plains of the Levantine, which extended from the Mediterranean to the Tigris, but they were pushed by Egyptians and others into the narrow region between Mount Libanus and the seashore, so they made the Mediterranean their home. Soon they commanded the entire commerce of the Mediterranean and became its most active pirates as well. Of all the towns, the biggest in activity and size was Tyre, which is in modern-day Lebanon. Phoenicians were celebrating antiquity for their wines, their salted fish, their mineral resources, but also for their learning. The Phoenician alphabet is probably their biggest lasting legacy. Overgrowth or discontent of the population lay at the root of emigration from Tyre. From 1000 to 600 BC, Tyre founded many colonies, all of them westward and on the Mediterranean coast. Herodotus, who visited Tyre around 450 BC, said that the city was 2,300 years old at the time. Now, he's often known to exaggeration and couldn't know the exact date, but other ancient documents of the Bronze Age in the Old Testament also mention Tyre prominently. Tyre resisted sieges from the Babylonians, the Persians, but was eventually conquered by the daughter states of Alexander the Great. Carthage was founded in the 9th century BC as a trading colony, and the new colony carried on the commercial affairs of the Athenians and eventually won the supremacy of all cities on the African coast. The population of Carthage was increased by immigration from the mother country. Its form of government was something of an aristocracy of capitalists, or maybe an oligarchy, you could say, with limited popular suffrage, controlled by a senate of 104 members. Aristotle called it a democracy inclining towards an oligarchy. The executive officers were two magistrates, who were like the Spartan kings, and annually elected by the citizens. But there was a council of 28 elders, elected at the same time, who possessed the main power. Well, whatever its form of government, Carthage was constantly at war, usually for commercial reasons. In the 6th century BC, the ruler Mago I is said to have laid the foundations of Carthage's solid military organization. The ruler was the first of a line of generals who made Carthage celebrated for 150 years for its military power. And its commercial navy grew into a military arm. The height of Carthage's power was from the beginning of the 5th to the middle of the 3rd century BC. Carthage was on the coast, but it stood on an overlook 200 feet above sea level, giving it an excellent view of the surrounding country and a great defensive situation. After the city of Carthage was destroyed in 146 BC, it was excavated and used as a quarry site throughout the Middle Ages. The Cathedral of Pisa in Italy, among many other structures, was built from blocks of marble dug from the ruins. Well, Hannibal came of age when Mediterranean powers scrambled to gain supremacy over neighboring states due to a power vacuum in the region. Carthage contended with Rome, the city-state of Syracuse, where Archimedes was from, and the deteriorating daughter states of Alexander's former empire, Macedon, the Seleucid Empire, and Ptolemaic Egypt. Hannibal certainly had the intelligence and determination to make his North African city-state the preeminent state in the ancient world. But for all of his successes on the battlefield, Hannibal was unable to achieve final victory over the other claimants to Mediterranean supremacy. This was partly due to his inability to win the long game of the Second Punic War, despite his successes at the short game. And for all of Hannibal's grand strategy as a military tactician, he failed as a statesman to convert military victories into political gains, and he also failed at the retail politics of winning over the Carthaginian aristocracy to his side. Hannibal's legacy is also distorted due to the biased sources that survive him. There are no historical accounts of his life that survived the Third Punic War and the Roman destruction of Carthage. No Carthaginians left any account of his life, and all that remain are accounts by Roman chroniclers, who are employed to present him as the enemy of civilization. So as a result, they depict his life and times in the most negative manner possible. Of the 37 authors that mention him, not a single comment is positive. But these authors had to admit that he was an incredible tactician even if this was to emphasize that his final defeat made Rome's ascendancy all the more glorious. Hannibal was born in 247 BC, and his father Hamilcar had led the Carthaginians at the end of the First Punic War with Rome. The war ended when Hamilcar surrendered Sicily to Rome and peace was negotiated. Not resting for a moment, he quickly set out to improve the fortunes of the state and fix its dismal financial condition. Hamilcar first subjugated the tribes of the Iberian Peninsula in order to get tribute from them. This wasn't simple because the Carthaginian navy was so strapped for resources after its war with Rome that the troops couldn't be transported by ship all the way to Iberia. Instead, they were marched to the Pillars of Hercules and crossed into Europe by being transported across the Strait of Gibraltar. Hamilcar took his young son on the campaign, but only under the condition that Hannibal swore never to be a friend of Rome. So Hamilcar was still licking his wounds after the loss in the First Punic War. At home, Carthage remained in a delicate situation. The government struggled to quell uprisings among former mercenaries who hadn't been paid for their services in the war. Rome took advantage of the disarray by capturing the Carthaginian islands of Sardinia and Corsica. Rome's eye was on territorial expansion at the expense of its enemy. Hamilcar succeeded in carving out new overseas territories of Carthage and Iberia by expanding upon initial dominions. He also had a reputation for lightning-fast raids. His speed in battle resulted in the honorary title that he received from other Carthaginians, Barak, or Barca. Barak in Semitic translates to lightning flash, and Hannibal carried this moniker as well. Hamilcar died in 229 BC by drowning in battle during the conquest of Hispania, or in Iberia. Hasdrubal, his son-in-law, succeeded him, who preferred accommodation to Rome instead of aggression. He consolidated Carthage's holdings in Iberia and signed a treaty with Rome stating he wouldn't expand north of the Ebro River as long as Rome didn't expand beyond its south. Before Hannibal took command of Carthaginian forces in Spain, he attained a high level of education. Some accounts claim that he followed the Greek military tradition of being tutored in the way that Alexander was by Aristotle, and some accounts claim that the young general took Greek tutors out on military campaigns, like in the case of the Spartan historian Sisalos, who accompanied Hannibal on his expedition across the Alps. And his education wasn't just for show. Hannibal, even in his exile after the Second Punic War, authored books in Greek, and one of his works pertained to campaigns conducted by his Roman enemy, Manlius Volso in Asia Minor. The book was written as a military manual for defending Rhodes. Anyway, let's get back to the treaty with Rome and Carthage that separated the two by a river. The treaty was really only an armistice. Hasdrubal worked quietly behind the scenes to shore up support on the European continent and raise up an army to attack Rome again. He arranged a marriage between Hannibal and the Iberian princess Imelce. Hasdrubal himself was a sharp tactician and prepared the overland campaign to Italy that Hannibal would execute years later. But none of his plans came to fruition as he was assassinated in 221 BC. Hannibal was appointed to succeed him at the age of 26. The young commander-in-chief quickly returned to his father's aggressive military approach. He completed the conquest of Hispania by capturing military fortifications and garrisons. Rome feared his growing strength and allied with the city of Saguntum, which was south of the river Ebro. Hannibal considered this a breach of the treaty signed after the First Punic War. He pressed on with the siege and captured Saguntum after 8 months before directing his attention toward Italy. The capture of Saguntum sat poorly with Rome. They demanded Hannibal's extradition for violation of the treaty. But Hannibal didn't want to wait for Roman forces to come to him and be deported to Rome and be tortured and executed. He consolidated his family's hold on power and appointed his brother, also named Hasdrubal, as commander. He crossed the river Ebro, and the Second Punic War with Rome officially began. Hannibal desired to carry the war through Hispania and Gaul into central Italy. His foes expected an easy defeat against a small city-state that was punching above its military weight. What they didn't expect was a protracted war against an enemy who used military tactics that had never been seen before in the ancient world, and a long, devastating war of attrition that would follow. Now let's take a little segue to look at how Carthage organized its military. For both its army and its navy, Carthage depended on mercenaries that it got from dependencies and other surrounding nations that it traded with. Carthage had the largest navy in antiquity because its harbors were massive, and it primarily consisted of triremes. Triremes were those ships with three rows of oars that were manned with one man per oar. This is what Carthage used up to about the 4th century when the trireme fell out of favor, and it was superseded by larger ships like quadriremes. Few Carthaginian citizens served in the military. The bulk of forces were made up by Phoenicians and Iberians and others, supplemented by light troops from all over its domains. But overall, its mercenary system was weak. It's kind of like a medieval Italian city-state compared to the Roman system of personal service. The generals in Carthage were under the control of the oligarchical leadership council, and so they didn't have full freedom of military operations. Overall, its discipline and arms and equipment were mostly inferior to Rome, and it didn't really surpass Rome in much except for fortification. Building defensive fortifications is very important if you have harbor cities that contain a lot of wealth and can be vulnerable to being ransacked if they're not well guarded. However, when the Carthaginian military was on the march, they didn't entrench a daily camp unless they came in contact with the Romans. The army was able to march well, but it was subject to epidemics due to the diverse population that made up its mercenary force. So there was also a diverse population of disease that was being mixed in as well. Carthage preferred military troops because many Carthaginian citizens were traders or rich planters and considered their time too valuable to the state, or they considered their social position too high to allow them to spend their years in the military ranks. For a trade empire, it came naturally to hire out military duties for its army and also its navy, which was manned by bought and hired crews. The harbor, dockyards, and arsenal of Carthage were well fortified, and they were the largest and most powerful of antiquity. Carthage could afford an abundant refuge for fleets, which were more numerous and efficient than any other afloat at the time. In terms of naval might, down to the Punic Wars, the warships of the Carthaginians were triremes and reached about 350 in the 3rd century BC, and they were rowed by slaves and manned by land troops. They had an enormous number of small vessels. In a treaty with Xerxes, in 480 BC, Carthage agreed to put afloat, at Xerxes' order, 2,000 war vessels and 3,000 transports. At the close of the Second Punic War, Carthage gave up 500 vessels to the Romans. Rowers were about three-fourths of the crew and were a standing force purchased by the government for this reason. Vessels were commanded by naval officers who were only under the control of generals when associated with an army. Land and sea forces were under the direct orders of the Senate. Hannibal controlled sea forces, but in his Italian campaigns, he mostly controlled land forces that were of less importance in the scheme of things for Carthage. And Roman and Greek sources detail Carthage's navy much more than it does its army. We find in Polybius, Appian, and Aristotle much more detail regarding the navy than the army of Carthage due to the importance that Carthage gave to its navy. For Carthaginian citizens, about the only place they were found in the military was in the cavalry, where wealth was required and you could receive honor there, and especially in an elite corps called the Sacred Band. It was the bodyguard of the commander-in-chief and kind of a training school for officers, sort of like the Macedonian pages. The Sacred Band consisted of 1,500 infantry, was well-clad and equipped, and one unit of the Carthaginian military noted for its discipline. Second importance came the cavalry that was 1,000 and strong and appears to form an appendage to the Sacred Band. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. So only approximately 2,500 who held Carthaginian citizenship served in the military, and in the army it could number up to 70,000 men. The next grade down in the military were land troops. The manpower pool here came from tributaries to Carthage. These tribes, found in Tunis and Libya, furnished a much higher number of troops than Carthage did itself. So foreign mercenaries were the bulk of the army. And these troops were recruited among all sorts of tribes in Africa and Europe. that Carthage had commercial relations with. Polybia says that the idea is of avoiding conspiracies and mutiny by the mercenary troops having no common political aspirations among the different divisions of the army. The only common bond they had was getting paid on time. Often, the different bodies didn't even understand each other's language, and they were typically devoted only to their immediate officer. His troops were farmed out by their respective governments in units of a few hundred or thousands. The best mercenary troops were Iberians from the Spanish Peninsula. Those considered the most recklessly brave were the Gauls, who at a very early period served for pay in the Carthaginian ranks. The most numerous were nomad soldiers collected from every part of the African coast, from Egypt to the Pillars of Hercules. So the recruitment plan was similar to the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire would assemble all peoples of the East, while the Carthaginians would assemble all peoples of the West. Roman historians and Greek historians, much in the way that they probably grossly overestimate the forces in Cyrus's army or Xerxes' army, also overestimate the number of forces in Carthage's army. But whatever the case in number and the total amount of manpower they had, Carthage was able to put together a massive force that is possibly as large as 100,000. So this makes the Punic Wars by far the largest military engagements in the Western Mediterranean, at least in the time of antiquity. Generals were chosen from the citizens of the people, and the system by which you were able to become an officer or general was similar to the British Empire, where you would buy your office. The Carthaginian military's biggest weakness was that it lacked discipline. It could overcome semi-developed states or tribal nations or tribal confederacies fairly easy. But whenever they met smaller armies of well-disciplined troops under good generals, then they were typically apt to fail. But this was not the case with Hannibal. When Hasdrubal was assassinated in 221 BC, the 26-year-old Hannibal was proclaimed commander-in-chief by the army. The Carthaginian government confirmed his appointment. The Roman scholar Livy depicted the young Carthaginian like this. No sooner had he arrived, the old soldiers fancied they saw Hamilcar in his youth given back to them. The same bright look, the same fire in his eyes, the same trick of countenance and features. Never was one in the same spirit more skillful to meet opposition, to obey, or to command. So let's pick up where we left off with the beginning of the Second Punic War. One of the first strategies that Hannibal enacted was to not directly attack the strongest position of his opponent. While Rome prepared for a Carthaginian attack on Sicily, Hannibal was determined not to repeat the mistakes of the First Punic War. He prepared an attack on Italy overland from the mountainous north via high altitude and precarious path. He departed Carthage in 218 BC. Hannibal marched across the Pyrenees with 38,000 infantry, 8,000 cavalry, and 37 elephants. Despite an early fall snow, Hannibal's massive army moved quickly, ferrying his elephants across rivers, and then crossing the Alps. It was an enormously risky maneuver that exposes forces to death by cold, starvation, or attack by blocked passages. Only half of Hannibal's forces that entered Italy survived the march. Nevertheless, Livy writes that he led the mountain crossing with ingenuity in the face of seemingly intractable problems. According to another Roman account, he used vinegar and fire to break through a rock fall. The gamble eventually paid off, as the Romans couldn't take any measures to halt his advance through Gaul. Hannibal secured the loyalty from Gaulish chiefs along the passage and prepared for an attack on Italy. Hannibal's crossing of the Alps in 218 BC is usually viewed as a military action that was completely reckless, and even though it was brave, he risked having his entire army freeze to death. But regardless of how risky the action was, the plan itself was fairly well planned by Hannibal. The Carthaginian general precisely weighed his options and decided to go for a calculated risk. It entailed years of planning and how his logistics network would line up, and some have attributed the original scheme of crossing the Alps to Hannibal's brother-in-law, Hasdrubal, or even possibly his father. And if the latter case is true, the Romans might have known about this plan, even if they didn't believe it could have been executed. The Roman consul, Publius Cornelius Scipio, was sent to intercept Hannibal's forces, but his commanders wrongly assumed he'd enter Europe via Iberia. He intercepted Hannibal with a small detachment from Gaul upon hearing of the mountain crossing. The clash at Ticinus at the Battle of Trebia, where Hannibal won a decisive victory using his cavalry forces. The battle was devastating for the Romans. Scipio was injured, and they had to abandon the Lombardy plains. Territories that the Roman Republic had recently conquered, including Gaul and Liguria, swore allegiance to Hannibal's nascent European empire, which helped to add to his depleted troop strength. Rome ordered a force led by Tiberius Sempronius Longus to bring his army back from Sicily and join up with the army of Scipio Africanus, the son of Publius Cornelius Scipio, to face Hannibal. Although Hannibal was unable to stop Sempronius and Scipio's armies from uniting, he could capitalize on the general's discordant methods of attack. While Sempronius assumed command over the more experienced Scipio, Hannibal planned his attack. He sent 2,000 soldiers, led by his brother Mago, in the cover of darkness to flank the Romans' encampment and lie in wait for battle. He then organized an attack for the next day. Using a strategy that he would use again and again in subsequent encounters, he placed his strongest troops on the flank, knowing that his enemy would attack at that point. Dawn arrived, and Hannibal sent a small cavalry force to entice the Romans to attack. When they took the bait, he was ready. The Romans used a standard three-column formation, flanked by cavalry. Eventually, the weaker Roman flank started to fail, at which point Mago's troops attacked and crushed the remaining resistance while Hannibal's troops pursued them. It's estimated the Romans lost as many as 20,000 troops. After their defeat at Trebia, the Romans brought in new leadership to challenge Hannibal, whom they realized had been dangerously underestimated. Gaius Flaminius replaced Sempronius. After a difficult crossing through marshlands in central Italy, he arrived in Etruria in the spring of 217 BC. Hannibal rampaged through the countryside and harassed villagers in an attempt to lure the Romans into another battle. He expected to play on Flaminius' fear of popular reproach for passivity. When he refused to engage him, Hannibal cut off the Roman troops from their supply lines to Rome. At this point, the Roman Senate demanded action. Flaminius prepared for battle near Lake Trasimene, where Hannibal set up his troops for an ambush. A narrow gorge was the only access to a small plain near the lake. Hannibal exposed his troops to the enemy near the gorge to entice the Romans to attack and positioned his heavy infantry while hiding his light infantry. Further to the west, he positioned his cavalry and additional troops in order to intercept a Roman retreat. To further confuse the Romans, he had campfires lit in the unoccupied Truro Hills. Flaminius arrived, ready to attack before his troops, commanded by Servilius Geminus, who joined his force. His impatience was rewarded in kind. Hannibal attacked with a small force that split Flaminius's front troops from the main army, then attacked them with his troops that had been waiting in the hills. The Romans fought gallantly, but were unable to mount an effective counterattack. Their westernmost troops were forced into the lake, the majority of the infantry was defeated, and the rest retreated. Over half of the 25,000 Roman soldiers were killed. Hannibal's maneuver, in which he marched around his opponent's left flank, was the first recorded turning movement in military history. Flaminius was killed, making it the worst ambush in Roman military history and to the Battle of Carrhae against the Parthenians. After this disastrous defeat, Rome finally began to take the threat of the Carthaginian general seriously. The only force that could prevent Hannibal's advance on Rome had been destroyed. The Senate appointed Quintus Fabius Maximus as dictator, with complete executive control to counter Hannibal's assault on the Italian peninsula. Fabius himself was a shrewd tactician and preferred cunning over a direct military assault on the power Carthaginian general. He crafted a strategy to exploit his opponent's two principal weaknesses. First, Hannibal had weak supply lines from Carthage to Italy. After all, resupply depended on enlisting the support of Rome's enemies to sell weapons, clothing, siege equipment, and other essential provisions. Second, Hannibal's army mainly consisted of mercenaries from Gaul and Spain that hated Rome more than they loved Carthage. They were suitable for direct pitch battle, but not for long sieges that required patience and equipment that they lacked. Fabius exploited these two disadvantages. He refused to directly engage the Carthaginian and forced him into a war of attrition. The general sent out small detachments against Hannibal's foraging parties, but never faced him in pitched battle. He dispatched several Roman armies in Hannibal's vicinity to limit his movements. Fabius led Hannibal into Italy's hilly terrain, nullifying the advantage of his cavalry. Villagers were instructed to flee into fortified towns and take their livestock and possessions with them upon sight of the Carthaginian army, depriving them of supplies or plunder. In this protracted war, Hannibal continued his trek down the southeastern corner of Italy, attacking towns, cutting off supply lines, and gaining control of the supply depot at Cannae. He ravaged Apulia and marched through the rich and fertile provinces of Samnium and Campania, but much to his dismay, he couldn't strike a fierce blow against the Roman army. Fabius' strategy was initially successful, but infuriated the Roman rank and file as a cowardly strategy. Older senators supported the campaign, but officers and soldiers considered it unbecoming of an army accustomed to crushing its enemies directly on the battlefield. Although it deprived Carthage of victory and stretched its forces thin, the strategy ultimately failed due to lack of support from the army. They were infuriated that Hannibal plundered Italy unopposed. Marcus Minucius Rufus, a political enemy of Fabius, was quoted as saying, "Did we come here to see our allies butchered and their property burned as a spectacle to be enjoyed? And if we are not moved with shame on account of any other, are we not on account of these citizens, a Carthaginian foreigner, who has advanced even this far from the remotest limits of the world through our inactivity?" In 216 BC, the Senate replaced Fabius with the Roman consuls Gaius Terentius Varro and Lucius Aemilius Paulus, and raise up an enormous army of 50 to 80,000 men. They're ready for battle at Cannae along the Aphidus River. Their plan was to attack with the strong, tight infantry at the center, which was flanked by the cavalry. Hannibal had set up his army with light infantry flanked by experienced infantry and cavalry. When the battle began, the Carthage forces surged forward, pushing back the Roman troops in what looked like a crescent. The cavalry on the left flank made quick work of their enemies and swung around to the rear of the Romans to assist their counterparts on the right flank. Hannibal then had his central infantry retreat slowly while those on the outside held their ground. At his order, they surged along with flanking cavalry. This maneuver, known as a double envelopment maneuver, is considered by most military historians to be Hannibal's masterpiece. It's a way for an inferior force to defeat a superior force on open terrain. The larger army advances to the center of the smaller army, which responds by moving its outside forces to the enemy flanks that surround it. Once a larger army is dispersed, a second layer of pinchers attacks on its most extreme flanks to prevent reinforcements. However, this maneuver is very difficult to execute, since it requires well-trained cavalry to successfully deploy the complex maneuver. Furthermore, the battlefield commander has to know the battlefield terrain very well, since any unknown feature of the landscape could leave him open to surprises from the enemy, which would disrupt the complex sequence of events that makes for a successful double envelopment. Hannibal executed the maneuver successfully, and the Romans were surrounded. He had severed their Achilles tendon. Despite having inferior numbers, he obliterated their forces. Over 50,000 troops were killed and 5,000 taken prisoner. Among the dead were three consuls, the quaestors, and 80 out of the Roman Republic's 300 senators. It was an enormous psychological blow to Rome, as well as a physical one. Rome had lost one-fifth of its population of males over 17 years of age due to this battle and three other campaign seasons. Much has been written about the Battle of Cannae, an encounter which resulted in the highest loss of human life in a single day in any battle recorded in ancient history. In terms of sheer numbers, the day probably accounted for over 40,000 Roman deaths. The figure is put at 55,000 by Livy and 70,000 by Polybius, which equated to about 80% of the Roman army fielded in the battle. To put this in perspective, the worst day in the history of the British Army usually pertains to the first day in the Battle of the Somme in 1916, World War I, when they lost about 20,000 men. But the male population of Rome in 216 BC is estimated to be about 400,000. So the Battle of Cannae took away about one-tenth to one-twentieth of the Roman male population, while Britain had a population of about 40 million at the beginning of 1901, with half of them males. So beyond just numbers, the encounter itself was a set-piece triumph for Hannibal, with a general strategy dictating the very choice of the battlefield itself. Another positive result of the victory at Cannae were all the supplies that were captured there. Rome was still dependent on the grain cultivated in native Italy, especially from the region of Apulia where Cannae was located. The choice of Cannae was an intentional ploy to provoke the Romans to give direct battle, as opposed to the Fabian strategy of delaying.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Hannibal's victories in battle brought many Italian city-states to his side. But these new vassals didn't provide him with sufficient troops or constitute a sufficient supply chain. Problems of fighting a war on foreign soil that had plagued his campaign since the beginning hadn't disappeared. Hannibal still lacked the resources to lay siege to Rome, an exceptionally well-fortified city that would take several months to capture. This was true even though he had captured Italy's second-largest city, Capua, which he had made into his base. Hannibal found his new Italian allies less than willing to fight, and at the same time, Carthage's leadership had offered him little support. Maharbal, the commander of the Numidian cavalry, commented on his predicament that, "Hannibal, you know how to gain a victory, but not how to use one." The diminishing fortunes of Hannibal's Italian campaign and a strategic stalemate with Rome pointed to an inevitable conclusion. He was a superior general but still lacked the resources to conquer his enemy. By then, Rome had adjusted accordingly. The Senate and army begrudgingly admitted the effectiveness of Fabius' strategy of retreat and called for its implementation. By leading Hannibal through a second war of attrition, Rome was able to regain control of Capua in 211 and then Syracuse after laying siege there. Hannibal still won victories, such as the destruction of two Roman armies in 212 BC and killing two consuls in a 208 battle. However, his Italian allies inadequately supported him, and the government of Carthage abandoned him, whether out of lack of supplies or jealousy. Factions of the Carthaginian oligarchy that favored peace soon shouted down the war party. Hannibal's army was forced out of Sicily, and Rome regained control. At the Battle of Herdonia and Locri Epizephri, Hannibal asked his brother to bring reinforcements from Iberia. However, he was unable to repeat his march across the Alps and was later killed in battle. Hasdrubal Barca's head was eventually delivered to his distraught brother. Finally, in 203 BC, after 15 years of warfare on the Italian peninsula, the general reluctantly returned to Carthage to stave off an invasion by Cornelius Scipio Africanus. Hannibal entered negotiations with Scipio. Carthage would lose its European holdings and pay a war indemnity. Rome wasn't confident that Carthage would honor any treaty terms, but it gained desired concessions from a defeated enemy. The peace appeared threatened when Carthage had a new surge of confidence due to the return of its leader and a Roman naval defeat at the Gulf of Tunis, but this change in fortunes was short-lived. Scipio defeated Hannibal's cavalry at the Battle of Zama and neutralized the effect of his elephants. The Roman general used the Carthaginian signature move against him and attacked Hannibal's rear flank, causing his formation to collapse. He was defeated and the army surrendered. With the loss of 20,000 troops, Carthage realized that the Second Punic War was no longer winnable. The dream of a Carthaginian empire that spanned the Mediterranean had ended. Despite being stripped of his command by Carthage's political leadership, Hannibal was able to find a new position within the state as a suffete, or chief magistrate. This wasn't considered a prestigious appointment, but he was able to wield enough power to improve Carthage's financial and judicial system. The 43-year-old instituted reforms, such as restructuring the city-state's economic system and overhauling the 104, a term for Carthage's Council of Judges. The city-state entered a period of prosperity. But proving no good deed goes unpunished, these reforms were Hannibal's final undoing. The economic restructuring caused the landed aristocracy to fear losing its power. Always jealous of Hannibal, they informed the Roman Senate that Hannibal's new alliance with the Seleucid Empire was part of a plan to invade Italy. Whether it was true or not, Rome demanded Carthage's surrender. Instead, Hannibal went into exile in the court of King Antiochus of Syria in 195 BC. Seleucia decided to invade Greece as the first stage of an invasion of Rome. Hannibal offered to lead the army, but he was only able to command a small fleet of ships due to the advice of Antiochus's advisors. He then attempted to convince the Seleucid king to invade Italy with an army under his command. This idea was never brought to fruition. Rome, sensing another attack on Italy, went on the offensive against the Seleucids, routing them at Thermopylae in 191 BC. They were decisively defeated at Magnesia in 190 by Scipio Asiaticus. To avoid the Romans, Hannibal had to flee once more. He sought refuge in the Armenian court of Artaxias, then in Crete, and finally in the court of King Prusias I of Bithynia. He served Prusias in an attempt to rally him against Pergamum, Rome's ally. Hannibal served as his naval commander and won victory over King Eumenes II of Pergamon. In one of the naval victories, he had large pots filled with venomous snakes thrown on their ships. He defeated Eumenes in two other battles on land, but then Rome intervened. They threatened Bithynia to give up Hannibal. Rather than surrendering, he poisoned himself in 182 BC. Despite failing in his ultimate military objectives, Hannibal's enduring legacy is as one of the greatest strategists of all time. His victory at Cannae and ability to attack the enemy's weakest flank has been replicated by generals as recently as Operation Desert Storm in 1991 by U.S. General Norman Schwarzkopf. He used his strategy to great success, despite his technological advantages of satellites and F-14s over Hannibal's cavalry, spears, and elephants. He arranged American forces to surround the Iraqis in a 100-hour war by successfully assaulting their rear flank. Despite Hannibal's successes in battle, he still wasn't able to win the war. His inability to build a permanent alliance with Italian cities doomed his invasion. But whatever Hannibal lacked as a politician, he was an effective general who was able to create an army out of a disparate group of people. The Roman chronicler Livy praises Hannibal's leadership skills by mentioning how he not only was able to control his mercenary army, which he called a hodgepodge of the riffraff of all nationalities, if we want to have a liberal interpretation of the Latin, but he also went on to win victories over the Roman forces for 15 straight years, and that within the confines of Italy. But beyond his charisma to lead such a diverse group of people, chroniclers also describe how he was able to inspire his troops. He slept alongside ordinary soldiers out in the open. He even went hungry along with his soldiers when supplies ran low. But more importantly, soldiers, despite their different origins, placed their trust in the Carthaginian commander when it came to actual battles. They followed the directives of their general due to their collective belief in the generalship of Hannibal Barca. Beyond warfare, Hannibal Barca also played a role in administration by revamping the state system of Carthage, fighting against corruption, embezzlement, and unpaid taxes. All these factors helped Carthage pay the war indemnity without heavily taxing the general public. He was also able to have former soldiers retrained and redeployed as farmers in the Carthaginian economy. So the efforts in the field of commerce and agriculture made Carthage prosperous. By 191 BC, the state was wealthy enough to pay off its entire war indemnity of 8,000 talents. Now it was paid over a course of 40 years in a lump sum. The levels of prosperity were reached at such an efficient rate that by 191 BC, the state was wealthy enough to pay off its entire war indemnity of 8,000 talents. Another legacy of Hannibal was inspiring hope among those who face impossibly long odds. When he was told by his generals that crossing the Alps with elephants was impossible, he responded with the Latin phrase, "I will either find a way or make one." Historian Theodore Eyrolt Dodge credits this attribute as the chief source of his success and most distinguished part of his legacy. And here's how he praises Hannibal as a military commander, inspirational figure, and above all, what he describes him as, a patriot. Hannibal excelled as a tactician. No battle in history is a finer sample of tactics at Cannae. But he was yet greater in logistics and strategy. No captain ever marched to and fro among so many armies of troops superior to his own numbers and material as fearlessly and skillfully as he. No man ever held his own so long or so ably against such odds. Constantly overmatched by better soldiers, led by generals always respectable, often of great ability, he yet defied all their efforts to drive him from Italy for half a generation. As a soldier, in the countenance he presented to the stoutest of foes and in the constancy he exhibited under the bitterest adversary, Hannibal stands alone and unequaled. As a man, no character in history exhibits a purer life or nobler patriotism. All right, high words of praise right there. Anyway, that is an overview and study of Hannibal for all of his strengths and all of his flaws.
Well, that's all I have for today. There's probably a million other things that could be said, but I think this is a good stopping point. First off, I want to give a shout out to the Spy Masters for the Knowlton's Rangers. Vic Austin, Chris, Rob Matlock, Alan Baker, Beverly Ingle, Jake Harrington, Todd Warren, William Ivey, Joyce Norman, Tyler from Colorado, Josh Reddick, Daniel Lawson, Marlene, Michael, Tim Clark, David Powell, Moondoggy from Ohio, Melissa, Chris from Maine, Carl from Norway, and Baron Fraser. I'll explain what that is in a second. If you like the show and want to help it grow, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps spread the word about the show. Two, join our Facebook group. Here we can keep the discussion going about new episodes, and you can talk about what you like and didn't like. And you can find this group if you just search for History Unplugged on Facebook. Three, we have an online store with t-shirts, phone covers, and other accessories featuring awesomely bad history puns that were crowdsourced by you, the audience. And you can find that if you go to teepublic.com and look for History Unplugged, or you just go to historyonthenet.com and look for our store there. Four, and this is really the best way to dive deep with History Unplugged, that's to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you know your American history, you know the Knowlton's Rangers were an elite spy and reconnaissance group in the American Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program of History Unplugged. You can join at three levels. If you join at the level of Scout, you can hear all the episodes of History Unplugged completely ad-free and get early access to new episodes, at least a week early. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get special bonus episodes, like a 10-part series on the World War II hero Audie Murphy, a multi-part series called Ottoman Lives about different people in the Ottoman Empire, and a series called Rendezvous with Death that looks at biographical profiles of Americans who went to fight in World War I before America entered the war. The last level is Spymaster, where you get all that stuff, but you also get three hardcover history books, Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt, Race to the Top of the World, Richard Byrd and the First Flight to the North Pole, and The Last Fighter Pilot, the true story of the final combat mission of World War II. Another bonus is, you can choose a history topic for me to focus on for an entire episode that can go up to an hour, and I'll answer whatever question you have for me, and you get a shout-out at the end of each episode. If you want to learn how to become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, go to patreon.com/unplugged. That's patreon.com/unplugged. All right, well, that is all for my spiel. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast, from ancient Greece to the Cold War and everything else in between. See you next time.